Welcome to CoreCast, a production of National Community Renaissance, a nonprofit affordable housing developer dedicated to solving the housing challenges facing seniors, veterans, and low-income families in America. CoreCast is a monthly podcast designed to expand interest in the area of affordable housing, as well as explore solutions and interview problem solvers in the industry. Welcome into CoreCast, episode one, a monthly podcast dedicated to discussing the affordable housing crisis in America. CoreCast is brought to you by National Community Renaissance, or National Core, as we like to call it around here, one of the largest affordable housing developers in the nation. My name is Jonathan Kendrick, and I'll be the co-host for the show alongside Steve Pontell, the president and CEO of National Community Renaissance. Steve, how are you doing today?
Jonathan, doing well.
Thanks for being here. And Steve, can you give the folks a little bit more information about who National Core is?
Absolutely. This is our 23rd year. We're a nonprofit affordable housing developer, and our purpose is to identify a way to transform the lives of our residents and the communities that we're in. There are four different aspects of our business. Number one, we're developers. We source and finance new development projects. We're also general contractors. We build the majority of our own projects. We manage most of our own properties, so we're a property management company, and then we deliver social services through our Hope Through Housing sister organization. And so we're excited to be a partner with many communities as they attempt to meet their housing challenges.
Now, the idea of this podcast is not just to discuss issues pertinent only to affordable housing, but as we'll see, affordable housing, the affordability of housing, impacts all areas of society. And Steve, can you give us a little bit of background on how affordable housing, the affordability of housing, and the current crisis we're seeing in our country affects all different sides of our society?
Absolutely. And just to start at the very beginning, it's one of the basic needs. It's food and
shelter.
We can fill it in and understand that if we do not adequately house our population, our communities and our country will not be able to be as successful as it should be. So it's important to understand that communities are incredibly complex systems, and all the parts of those systems have to be working together. And the housing component is one of the linchpins to a successful community. It has a direct effect on health. People that are adequately housed are healthier than people that are not. You can best imagine it as understanding being homeless is not a very healthy lifestyle. Homeless people use our healthcare infrastructure at the highest price point. And people that are living in overcrowded conditions, people that are living in substandard housing, people that are living in unhealthy housing, all of that has a negative impact. Similarly, with regard to educational performance, children that are living in substandard housing or in overcrowded conditions do not perform as well in education as children that are adequately housed. The long-term ripple effect that has on our society is obvious. So when you think about housing, it's important to think about it as a linchpin for the entire community to be successful.
Now, as our country continues to recover from the Great Recession, we're starting to create more jobs. Communities across all the country are creating jobs, but not as necessarily as much housing to go along with those jobs. And what kind of problems does that create for communities?
Right. Jonathan, you cannot have a successful economic development strategy if you do not have an adequate and applicable housing strategy to go along with it. It is irresponsible for communities to allow jobs to be developed for which there are not housing for the people that are going to be employed in those jobs. And in the long run, those communities are ensuring their own economic demise as their population will continue to age in place and as young workers and executives will not be able to live in those communities. So ultimately, the jobs will follow the people. If you want to have a successful economy, if you want to be a successful community, you have to be sure that you're providing housing for today and into the future. You know, one of the things I find most interesting is the number of communities where the children growing up in those communities are not going to be able to live in those very communities. And I don't understand the perspective of the parents, unless maybe they don't want their children nearby, but they probably want their grandchildren within reach. And so the number of communities that are not ensuring housing for the future of their own population is very disturbing.
Now, over the course of this podcast, we'll be looking at issues that affect all corners of the United States and discussing issues on a national level. But this crisis is especially impactful here in California, in our backyard. Steve, can you talk a little bit about the special circumstances that we've seen here in California that have just kind of shown a real huge impact of what the housing crisis has done and what it could lead to in other places across the country as well?
Absolutely. And first, let me indicate the National Corps not only is in California, we're also in Arkansas, Texas, and Florida. And every state has their own unique housing challenges. One of the challenges we have in California is the costs are completely out of control. And if you just take a look at a couple of critical factors, according to the Legislative Analyst Office, the average home price in the United States is $180,000. The average home price in California is $440,000. The average rent in the United States is $800 a month. The average rent in California is $1,240 a month. Approximately 30% of renters are having to spend 50% of their income to be able to afford housing, which has a very negative effect on the families that are trying to move up and trying to meet basic needs, as well as a negative effect on the communities where they live because disposable income is so much less. And if you think about the challenges we have in California, where we have an estimated 1.5 million housing units short for the population that lives here today, Southern California is somewhere around 700,000, 750,000 housing units short. And you just play that forward. And the primary consequence of that is massive overcrowding. So those communities across the country that are not providing an adequate supply of housing are ensuring that their future is going to be very difficult because the people are living somewhere. And if you have overcrowding in a neighborhood where you're exceeding design capacity, you designed the neighborhood for 100 people, you have 200 people living in that neighborhood, the roads, the water, the sewer, police, the fire, the parks, the schools are all going to deteriorate faster than they were designed for. This is not complicated. This is basic math. And in California and in other places, when you have such a shortage of housing, you have to try and take a look at what are the distortions in the marketplace that are causing that. Why is it that the market is not able to keep up with housing? Those are the kinds of questions I'm hoping we can really dig in during this podcast. So it's not just about getting more subsidy, although subsidy is critical, especially for certain populations. You know, it's incredibly disturbing when you take a look at the number of homeless veterans we have and how little we've been able to really affect and support that population, let alone all aspects of the developmentally disabled and people that are dealing with different mental and medical conditions. And I mean, there are all sorts of populations across the country that we should be thinking about and paying special attention to make sure that their housing needs are being met and to make sure that our communities can be successful going forward.
So as part of this podcast, we will be engaging with experts from various fields. You'll hear experts, for example, in healthcare discussing the affordable housing crisis. You'll hear experts in affordable housing engaging in education and so on. And our hope is that by tearing down these silos, we can begin to address these important issues in a holistic way. We want to make this issue a dinner table, a water cooler type conversation. You know, most people don't realize it yet, but if this crisis is not solved, we're going to be talking about affordable housing, much like we talk about crime statistics or the price of a gallon of milk. You know, Steve, you talk about this and you talked about it in your testimony before the California State Assembly's Committee on Housing and Community Development, that the discussion right now in California is heavily on water issues and the drought. But you've made the argument that the affordable housing crisis is even bigger than the water shortage crisis.
Absolutely. Because the water crisis, not only has it captured the attention of the legislature and the leadership of the state, it has very specific solutions. There are no solutions today being discussed to meet the housing needs of California and the long-term impact, the negative impact on people, families, and our communities is going to ultimately result in a decline of the quality of life in California. If we don't bump this up on the agenda, and if we don't do a concerted effort to address it across the country, then the consequences are going to be more severe.
So let's talk a little bit about what you can expect to hear from this podcast each month. Because we think that this discussion is important not only to the affordable housing community, but to all Americans, our podcast is intended to have a little something for everyone. Each month, we'll start our podcast with a water cooler conversation about what's news in the affordable housing industry and with the housing crisis. This may include statistics, issues, concerns, whatever is of interest and pertains to the need for affordable housing. Next, we'll bring in others to the conversation that can enlighten us on different issues that tie into our ongoing discussion. These individuals may be policymakers in government, they may be in education, healthcare, or other fields. The need for affordable housing really does affect us all. Then we'll hear from Michael Novogradac, the managing partner in the San Francisco office of Novogradac & Company, who is gracious enough to summarize the most pertinent issues from his Tax Credit Tuesdays podcast for use in our podcast each month. And we'll be facilitating a discussion in this month's podcast with Mark Steinorth, a California State Assemblyman, to hear more about what the legislature is doing to tackle the affordable housing crisis.
I'm very excited to bring Assemblyman Mark Steinorth into the conversation about not only the future of housing, but the future of California and some of the challenges that we face. Assemblymember Steinorth, introduce yourself to our podcast audience.
Thank you very much, Steve. First, I would like to thank you for inviting me here today. My name is Mark Steinorth. I hail from Rancho Cucamonga as a military brat, lived all over the world. I currently represent the 40th Assembly District, which includes Rancho Cucamonga, Redlands, Highland, Loma Linda, and about 68% of San Bernardino.
Very good. Well, welcome. So our podcast is geared towards informing people about the opportunities and challenges associated with housing, but to do it in a way that everybody is going to be interested in the conversation because housing has such a universal impact. You know, as we say, it's food and shelter. It's not complicated as far as how important it is. But since you've been in the Assembly, tell us a little bit about the committees you're on and some of the activities that you're currently participating in.
Of course. Well, I was fortunate enough to be assigned as Vice Chair of Housing, which, you know, is probably the reason I was inviting on your show today. And then I serve on the government organization. Thirdly, I'm on the Health Committee, which, if you've been paying attention to the vaccine bill or the Right to Die bill or some of the other issues that are going around, those are really hot button issues, and all of them will be presented and discussed in this committee.
Very good. Now, this is your first term in office.
That's correct.
How long have you been up there now?
I think it's May 27th, so it's been about six months.
And biggest surprise since you've been there?
Okay, well, I'm going to be a little snarky first. I'll say that my daughter is a freshman in high school, and she and I have learned to communicate much better now. I've become fully fluent in sarcasm.
I can imagine that. So how did you end up getting the vice chairmanship of housing?
Frankly, I think it stems from my previous activity as a council member for the city of Rancho Cucamonga and the dedication that Rancho Cucamonga has had towards affordable housing, senior housing, workforce housing. The speaker, Toni Atkins, really her intentions, as she's expressed to me, was really not to become speaker in her tenure as an assembly member. She wanted to be chairperson of housing, and she ultimately was a vice chair of housing. She saw the abilities that she was able to bring to the table there, but she saw the limitations and the restrictions. She has now Ed Chow as housing chair, and then myself as vice chair, and she's really hoping that the combination of both of our backgrounds, skills, talents, would be able to move some of the issues that she cares about forward.
That's great. Now, Rancho Cucamonga, for those of you who don't know, is a city in the Inland Empire, and it has paid a lot of attention to affordable housing. How have you seen that, or why did you see that as an important focus for the city?
Well, the city understands, the city, first of all, has been very smart in the way that they created a plan, they laid out the plan, they met with all stakeholders at the formation of the city nearly 36 years ago, and they laid it all out in a master plan, and they stuck to it. And that's something that I think a lot of us and a lot of municipalities, you know, really could learn from or possibly could revisit. And they understood, the city, you know, fathers at that time, you know, the pioneers understood that to be able to have all the different demographics represented as far as, you know, different age, ethnicity, income levels, they needed to make sure that the city was structured so that people would have places that they could live.
Very good. It's an interesting challenge in California because I think it's important that we think not only about, you know, the need for subsidized housing for certain populations, but just why is it that the cost of producing housing has become so great and the barriers to the production of housing have become so great? I think the Ledge Analyst Office is currently projecting that California is about 1.5 million housing units short for the population that lives here today. So if we built 1.5 million new housing units today, we would be at even. And obviously when you have that kind of a supply shortage, your prices are disproportionately high. And so the median price of a house in California is about $440,000, whereas the median price of a house nationwide is $180,000. So what are some of the things that you've observed that are creating the obstacle for the production of enough housing in California? Why are we so far behind?
It's a great question. And we've had a lot of discussions about this specific topic. I had this one witness come into one of our hearings and explain to us that affordable housing and the CEQA process, he was a really intelligent witness, probably one of the smartest persons I've had in the room at that time, talked about the CEQA process and affordable housing basically creating a Christmas tree where everybody puts another ornament to be able to really try and make it that much more burdensome for the development. Of course, I'm talking about yourself. It's your show, so I figured I'd flatter you. But no, it's true.
$5.
Thank you very much. I'll have to report that. But the challenge, though, is, of course, CEQA really is going to be one of those hurdles. And as you understand and the listeners understand, by creating that time frame, that extra year, 2 years, 3 years between when you start construction or create your pro formas before you actually start construction, that's a tremendous amount of time that you're losing opportunity. And it's an opportunity cost that is really hard to overcome. Now, when I have discussions with other colleagues in the legislature about how can we really look at trying to reform CEQA, it's been expressed to me that really that is the third rail of Democratic politics. CEQA reform is equivalent to what I would look at as somebody trying to reform Prop 13. It's something that I just will not address, will not attempt. I believe that Prop 13 needs to stay stabilized the way it is, and it has a reason for it to be there. And it isn't, the CEQA reform reluctance isn't because of the environmentalists wholly. It actually has a lot to do with project labor agreements, prevailing wage, and the trade unions. I find that fascinating.
Right. It's very frustrating when you see CEQA being used as an obstacle to a development, and the goal of the people using it has nothing to do with the environment. I mean, and so that's the kind of challenge that has become rampant in the abuse, quote unquote, of CEQA as we go forward.
Right. Now, I find fascinating, though, because when we talk in the context specifically of affordable housing, we know that because there's a government finance component that goes into affordable housing, a lot of times PLAs and prevailing wage are one of those Christmas tree ornaments that's going to be put into that multi-layer cake. So why there needs to be the CEQA still applied to be able to protect those, I find that to be a bit of a disconnect. If we say, okay, you're going to get the PLAs, you're going to have prevailing wage, allow us to gain that 24 or 36 months of opportunity cost back, you would think that that would be able to provide those trades jobs earlier, sooner, more readily available. That seems to me that there's a bit of a negotiated agreement there somewhere to be made, and certainly a conversation that needs to keep happening.
Right. It's interesting. I think that one of the examples I used, if I was a billionaire building a football stadium, I could be protected from the abuse of CEQA. And I think it's a great idea to think about getting the trade unions as partners in the conversation, because unfortunately, more often than not, it's the not in my backyard,
correct,
anti-growth people that will then use CEQA because they've got theirs and they don't want to see anything new happening anywhere near them. And so, I mean, it's a great idea to think about getting the trade unions as partners, mm-hmm, and how do we build more housing for the population that's already here.
And I think a lot of that has to be with changing the dialogue by having, as you stated, making them partners to be able to have that relationship, to develop it over a little bit more time, which, of course, then that transitions to term limits and the fact that we have more time as assembly members or as senators up there in the Capitol to build these relationships so that the trade unions don't feel that their one thing that they have already ingrained is not going to be stripped away forevermore. To be able to say, no, we can come to a compromise for this carve-out, which is affordable housing, and let's see how we can hold those elements that you find sacred there, but allow us the flexibility to be able to overcome it. One of the things I attempt to do this year, which ultimately I've pulled back and made into a two-year bill, and forgive me, I don't know the assembly bill number, because there's 2,200 numbers, and But it's a CEQA reform that's specifically carved out in conservancy districts. It, what most Californians don't understand is about 58% of the state, pretty much all of the developable parts of the state, have been shrouded in this overlap map called a conservancy district. And that makes it so that it's almost impossible to get a CEQA exemption. So I introduced legislation that did hit a roadblock, but instead of just getting a headline, I've pulled it back to overcome their objections, make it a little longer of a process of a sale. And we're hoping that we'll be able to carve out where in those particular areas we can start having a greater conversation about the reforms.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. In San Bernardino County, your home county, I think most people don't realize that 81.5% of San Bernardino County is owned by the federal government.
That's correct.
And so when you think about the amount of limitation on development that already exists statewide, it's phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And that's a huge East Coast versus West Coast difference, because on the East Coast, the federal government ownership of land is dramatically less. In the whole Western United States, the federal government owns anywhere from 35 to 60% of entire states.
Correct.
So that's something that, you know, should be taken into consideration to balance out the additional environmental regulations that are put on development.
Totally agree.
So another issue that, you know, I think you experienced from the city council side was the elimination of redevelopment. And redevelopment was one of the primary tools to provide additional funding for affordable housing. And with redevelopment going away, it's had a pretty dramatic effect on what local government can do and how local government can influence and partner in the production of affordable housing where local government wants it to go. So what are you hearing and seeing? And I know the speaker is championing ideas about, you know, additional resources to potentially make up for the loss of some of those redevelopment resources. How are you seeing that play out in Sacramento?
Well, there's two bills that have been introduced that are really trying to address that specifically. One, I feel, is more on the market side base. Its author is David Chu from San Francisco. Really nice guy, very smart. It's Assembly Bill 35, and I did sign on as a principal co-author. It effectively creates tax credit structure of upwards of $300 million, which, again, I'm a big market-based person, so, you know, tax credits, that works for me. Because the speaker is a author on the bill as well, it has a greater likelihood of passing. The speaker herself, though, actually introduced AB 1335, and it's referred to as the speaker's bill because she's put so much of her own political capital into making sure that this bill gets to move forward. It is a two-thirds bill, so she needs all of the Democrats to vote and at least two Republicans to vote aye on this bill. It's my understanding she's probably going to come about possibly up to three or four Democrats short. She may not be able to rally her own troops because there are some that have a very specific disagreement with the approaches he's taking. But the idea is this. The speaker would create a permanent source of funding for affordable housing, and the creation would come from a $75 per transaction fee, maxing out at $225. So it's a document fee, not transaction, a document fee, but it's $225 per ultimate transaction. So you decide to refinance your house. You go ahead and sign multiple documents for the first, you know, what is it, $225 worth of documents, you'll be paying that fee. It's something that will impact San Bernardino County tremendously. The assessor's offices are unified against this bill. The California Association of Realtors ultimately were against this bill originally. They have since switched their position and are now supportive because the speaker carved out an amendment that it will not impact new transactions. So it would really impact people that are putting a tax lien, a mechanics lien, you know, refinancing, those types of transactions on your home structure. It's something that, as I stated, is a little bit controversial because it's a new form of tax. It's a new way that currently is not in our tax code. And some of the fears that Republicans will have and some conservatives will have is once you start a new form of taxation, increasing it becomes that much easier after it's already been established.
Now, one of the challenges, I think, with that is also, if the fee were to go into effect, how do the dollars get distributed around the state?
Correct.
And I know many of us from Southern California were very frustrated with the first round of the dollars from the cap and trade initiative. Good or bad, those dollars were about 84% of those dollars ended up going to Northern California. And so one of the things that we're very cautious about is if any fee were to be opposed, how that fee gets distributed.
Correct. And that is something where San Bernardino County, it's my understanding, speaking with the county officials, they if they took this particular fee structure and applied it to the amount of transactions that occur on an annual basis, it would generate about $18 million worth of revenue taxes. And the way it's structured at this point, we would not see the $18 million coming back reinvested into our county. So that's certainly something that we feel is an area of negotiation, an area for amendments. I've been personally, because I am vice chair of housing, the Republican caucus has put it as one of my key careabouts to make sure that I'm interfacing with the speaker's office and with the speaker herself to be able to share with her some of the concerns that we have. As I mentioned earlier, she would need at least two, possibly up to five Republican votes to be able to pass this bill. That does give us an opportunity and a leverage point to be able to have these conversations and to be able to try and balance that out. Now, I mentioned also that some of the Democrats would not be in support. I know that my colleague here in the adjacent district, Cheryl Brown, she's made it clear to the speaker in previous incarnations during the last session that she was not in support because she did not like the idea that San Bernardino County becoming a donor county and having our money redistributed to the wealthier, more urban areas of San Francisco, Sacramento, and Los Angeles.
Right.
And San Diego.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the challenges that obviously statewide we have a housing challenge. We need to make sure the resources, to the extent they become available, are available statewide. And to the extent possible, the more local control, the better. Because I think one of the other challenges we have is as cities have lost the ability to really partner and facilitate development, more and more control is shifting to Sacramento.
Correct.
Something I think we want to guard against.
Agreed.
So just a last point, and this is kind of one of my pet points. Whenever you see a distortion in the market, you can kind of take a step back and ask why. And in California, it's estimated that we're 2 times overbuilt for retail, 3 times overzoned for retail. At the exact same time, we're 1.5 million housing units short. So obviously, cities have a huge incentive to try and promote as much retail as possible and a disincentive in the production of housing. Because it's the average development impact fee per housing unit per door is $70,000 to $80,000 statewide. So you just tack that onto the cost of producing every housing unit. Any thoughts about how we might be able to get that distortion, into better alignment, where cities aren't so over anxious to promote retail, but understand the importance of housing?
Okay, so we've had this conversation, and I have been working on that particular issue. I've had the opportunity of meeting with John Chung's office, the treasurer's office, and with the speaker's office specifically about how can we, when you try to eat a camel, you can't swallow it all at once. Perhaps you can just take one bite at a time. The challenge that I'm coming across is any discussion that we have about swapping the retail sales tax for property tax immediately brings up the third rail of Prop 13. And then the discussion stops. So what I've been trying very cautiously and carefully to do is say, well, let's draw a line in the sand. Let's start discussing incremental ways. One of the points that you bring up also, Steve, is discussing a city's housing element. And perhaps, back to the CEQA reform aspect, having the conversation with the cities and say, well, maybe you can actually go through a full EIR process on your housing element and allow developers to use that as an umbrella under which they then don't have to go through the process again. Now, of course, the rebuttal is most cities don't go through a true EIR process for the housing element. Well, that's where supply side economics would jump in there. If the cities are interested in actually developing, they would have a housing element that would be accurate. If they're not interested, then so be it. Developers will go where it makes sense for them to make the most money and to develop the most efficiently. The same thing with the retail side. If we say to the cities, which are, as we all know, living off of the retail, we're going to allow you to get a greater proportion share of your rooftops effectively. Well, how do you balance that out from the urban, from the suburban? We have higher density in some of the areas in the urban areas and less density, of course, in suburban. So then we look at it and say, well, why don't we do it where we draw a line and say all new development based on per unit, we can see a greater portion of property taxes going into the city governments. Now, that seemed to carry legs, it caught legs, with John Chung's office, and it started moving through the speaker's office, and then it kind of hit a wall at the governor's. The governor's attitude at this point, and this is not coming from the governor specifically, but emissaries, is that any development would occur anyway. So any line in the sand and talk about incremental growth as if you are creating new development, as if it truly is a construction, their attitude is any development will occur naturally regardless of what the incentives are, and they're not as encouraged about the idea of incentives.
Well, it's definitely, I think, a long-term challenge for cities.
Agreed.
Because what cities are addicted to in the sales tax is a shrinking percentage of the economy that's actually sales taxable.
Correct.
And if cities want to be able to participate in the whole economy, there's going to have to be some rethinking about how we do that.
But see, that argument is what's giving the impetus behind SB 8 by Senator Hertzberg, where a sales tax would now actually be attributed to all transactions, to services, as well as to products sold. So they would say, okay, you're right. Let me just go ahead and play a little judo and say, well, let's add that 8.25%, 8% on everything, and then cities will not have to have that fear.
Right, and that obviously would be a significant challenge on the economy.
Tremendous. I think it's upwards of $100-some billion they're talking about. So a significant amount of money that would be coming out of the private sector side going into the public sector.
Right. So Mark, I very much appreciate you taking time. Any last thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, I'm honored to be in the service of the 40th Assembly District. And, you know, it's something that we take very seriously. Before this interview and conversation that we've had, the question was asked, you know, what do you really think about the job? And frankly, if you take the job seriously, you will put more energy and time than you possibly thought was necessary. And you will always have more that needs being, you need to touch. So I just thank everybody that trusted me with their vote. And I put myself out there to be your emissary and your voice.
Very good. We do very much appreciate all the hard work that you do.
Thank you very much.
Hello, I'm Michael Novogradic, the managing partner of Novogradic & Company, LLP. We're a national CPA firm specializing in tax, audit, and consulting services for tax credit-assisted developments, especially multifamily affordable housing. I'm here today to share with you some affordable housing news highlights that were featured over the past month in my weekly Tax Credit Tuesday podcast. If you're ready, let's get started. Let's start off with news about a House bill that would expand funding for the Long-Term Housing Tax Credit and the National Housing Trust Fund. If passed, the bill would increase the per capita allocation for Long-Term Housing Tax Credits from $2.30 to $2.70. The legislation would also provide a 50% eligible basis boost for rental housing that targets extremely low-income households. This means an added incentive for developers to serve households that need affordable housing the most, as well as a better way or an additional method to close the financing gap for such developments. The bill's changes would be effective for low-income housing tax credit allocations made in calendar year 2015 or later. The proposal would also expand Section 8 rental assistance and the Public Housing Capital Fund. The bill was introduced, or I should say reintroduced, in March by Representative Keith Ellison, a Democrat from Minnesota. The legislation would also benefit the National Housing Trust Fund. As listeners may know, the National Housing Trust Fund was authorized by Congress in 2008 to help finance the production and preservation of affordable housing. The bill would essentially use revenue from mortgage interest savings to create a permanent source of funding for the National Housing Trust Fund. As some of you may recall, Representative Ellison introduced a similar bill in the 113th Congress. Ellison said in a press release that his new bill would generate more than $200 billion in revenue over 10 years. He said this would help provide critical resources to address the national rental shortage. You can find a copy of the Common Sense Housing Investment Act of 2015, or H.R. 1662, at www.taxcredithousing.com. And while we're on the subject of potential legislative changes, a group of about 50 organizations recently sent a letter to leaders of both the House and the Senate. They urged the leaders to protect the tax-exempt status of municipal bond interest. Signatories called the tax exemption a cornerstone of state and local infrastructure investments, which includes affordable housing and community development. The letter said that repealing or reducing the tax exemption would be detrimental to national infrastructure development and the municipal bond market. In those situations, the letter argued that bondholders would demand higher interest rates to offset the taxes newly imposed on such bonds. It said increased borrowing costs for state and local governments would be passed on to businesses and individuals, ultimately stifling job creation and economic growth. I should make it clear that municipal bonds are a broad category that includes private activity bonds, of which multifamily bonds are a part. That's in addition to the better-known state and local general obligation bonds. The letter is designed to push back on several efforts to repeal taxes and bonds. Former House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Dave Camp proposed repealing private activity bonds. President Obama has repeatedly included a proposal to cap municipal bond income at a 28% tax rate in his annual budget proposals. The Wyden-Coates tax reform bill would also repeal private activity bonds. The letter signatories call themselves the Don't Mess With Our Bonds Coalition. Some of the organizations that signed on include the National Council of State Housing Agencies and the National Association of Local Housing Finance Agencies. We've posted a copy of the letter for you in the advocacy section of the Novogratz Affordable Housing Resource Center. Go to www.taxcredithousing.com, hover over the legislation tab, and click on advocacy. Next, I'd like to talk to you about a notice published recently regarding rental assistance transfer rules. This notice establishes the terms and conditions by which the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, will approve a request for the transfer of project-based rental assistance, debt held or insured by the HUD secretary, and statutorily required income-based use restrictions from one multifamily housing development to another. The HUD secretary has the authority to approve transfer requests for fiscal years 2014 through 2016. According to the notice, HUD will evaluate these requests on a case-by-case basis following these criteria. The receiving property must be a multifamily housing development prior to or as a result of the transfer. The receiving development may already be HUD affiliated, meaning that it has existing HUD project-based rental assistance, an existing use restriction, or debt that is either HUD held or FHA insured. The receiving property may be existing, under construction, newly constructed, undergoing substantial rehabilitation, or undergoing moderate rehabilitation. Finally, before Section 8 project-based rental assistance is transferred to the receiving property, the property must exist and be habitable. The notice is important because it helps property owners determine whether a transfer is feasible for their particular multifamily property. Plus, it could help owners formulate their requests in a way that adequately addresses the criteria. This ultimately means a more efficient process for HUD and property developers. The notice became effective April 30th, and HUD has begun accepting requests for transfers. For more details, check out the HUD notice at www.hudresourcecenter.com. In additional HUD news, the department issued guidance on the maximum per unit subsidy for the home program. The guidance was necessary because HUD previously followed the limits listed for the Section 221(d)(3) mortgage insurance program. Well, the Federal Housing Administration, FHA, suspended that program in 2013, unless the development also receives low-income housing tax credits. That meant it stopped publishing limits requiring HUD to find an alternate rule for the home program. The notice established an interim policy for field office staff and participating jurisdictions. It instructed them to use the Section 234 condominium housing basic mortgage limits for elevator-type projects. That's until a new final rule takes effect. HUD did not specify when a new final rule would be released. So in the meantime, participating jurisdictions that use home funds need to check Section 234 limits that are published annually in the Federal Register. HUD recommends that participating jurisdictions contact the Community Planning and Development Team and their local HUD field offices. HUD warned participating jurisdictions against calculating their own limits. If you have questions about the subsidy limits or HUD programs, please contact my partner, Renee Beaver, in our Cleveland, Ohio office at 216-298-9000. I want to close out our report today with some state-level news here in California. The California Housing Finance Agency, or CalHFA, last month introduced a new bond program. The California Conduit Issuer Program helps affordable housing developers access tax-exempt and taxable bond funds. Developers can use the funds to acquire, rehabilitate, and develop existing or new construction affordable housing throughout California. The program is available to both for-profit and nonprofit developers, and nonprofit developers will receive discounts of the issuance fees for loans totaling $20 million or more. The conduit program does have a few affordability requirements. Either 20% of a development's units must be rent-restricted and occupied by individuals earning 50% or less of area median income, or AMI, or alternatively, 40% or more of the units must be both rent-restricted and occupied by individuals earning 60% or less of the AMI. Furthermore, state law requires that at least 10% of these units be reserved for residents earning at or below 50% of the area median income, or AMI. To learn more about the Condo Additional Program or to print out an application, go to www.calhfa.ca.gov. That's www.calhfa.ca.gov. Well, that brings me to the end of this week's report. For more tax credit news, tune into our weekly Tax Credit Tuesday podcast. It's available on iTunes and on the Novogratz website at www.novoco.com/podcast. This is Michael Novogratz. Thanks for listening.
So, Jonathan, I think we did a pretty good job today trying to capture the essence of the challenges associated with housing.
Not bad for the first episode of CoreCast, and we hopefully will be able to delve into more issues over the coming months. I thought it was very interesting today to have some different aspects. First, just an introduction into what's going on in affordable housing right now, then to be able to discuss with Mark Steinorth, who is in the California State Assembly, discussing bills, moving bills forward that deal with these issues that we discuss every day, and then as well to hear from Michael Novogratz on some of the specifics in regards to legislation at the federal level, across states and the local level as well.
Right. I think it's important, and if there's any way at all we can get this point across, that if you care about health, you should care about housing. If you care about education, you should care about housing. If you care about the economy and jobs, you should care about housing. Because it's such an integral part of how we as a society can be successful and produce a quality of life that we would want for ourselves, our children, our neighbors. And the one main takeaway that I'm hoping comes out of this is that policy matters. At the end of the day, the policies that we structure determine how our economy is moving. And when we create distortions in the marketplace, the market responds to that. And the current distortions in California are causing us to underproduce the housing necessary. And hopefully this will be a cautionary tale for the rest of the states, because to be able to consciously be thinking about the impact of the production of necessary housing when you're considering every other policy that you're enacting, I think is absolutely critical for a successful community.
And so we'll sign off every month with our most important thing. And I think mine for this month's podcast was, as you say, Steve, just how interrelated everything is in a community. And in policy as well, we heard Assemblyman Steinorth discussing how there are certain issues that come up, whether they were taxation or whether they were funding for a new source for affordable housing, and all the other parts that are related to that, and considering all the different effects with one piece of legislation or with one issue, and how we can bring as many people as possible to the table to discuss these issues, to get out of the silos as we talk about and have a look at an issue and all the issues that it impacts as well. And hopefully this podcast can be a place, can be a meeting place for those type of discussions.
Absolutely. Thank you, Jonathan. Good job.
And thank you, Steve. This has been the first episode of CoreCast, a production of National Community Renaissance. You can find out more information about our organization and the podcast at www.nationalcore.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast via iTunes, and we look forward to hearing from you via email. If you have comments, suggestions, questions, you can contact us at jkendrick, J-K-E-N-D-R-I-C-K at nationalcore.org. We'll be back in July for episode 2 of CoreCast. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you then.